All right, welcome to a very special episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show is actually a director follow-up episode. We're following up last week's episode on To Dust with an interview with the film's writer-director, Sean Snyder. Sean was so gracious to come and spend a bunch of time here on the show talking about all kinds of just film geek stuff and getting into all the movies and directors that influenced him. And it's just a great conversation. I'm really excited to share it with you all. And, you know, before we jump into it, I do want to remind you, please make sure if you're not already to make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. And also follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. And while you're at it, join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, a movie discussion group. So with that said, you've already listened to last week's episode on To Dust, which means that you've already watched the movie. You should, because we will be getting into spoilers. So now that you've done all that, let's get into this conversation. All right, so with us right now is Sean Snyder, the writer-director of To Dust. Sean, thank you so much for being here.
It is my pleasure. I'm very excited for the conversation.
I'm very excited myself, too. As you heard in our previous episode, I really, really loved your film. It's one of my favorite movies this year so far, so I was just really glad that you were able to do this interview, and it's such a unique movie that talking about influences and inspiration, it's kind of a funny one to get to talk to a director on, because there's so much originality involved here. The first thing I wanted to talk about, you know, and we're going to get into some of those inspirations and influences and all that kind of stuff, but for such a unique film as To Dust, where did the initial spark, what would you say it came from when you started, coming up with this thing?
Well, it merges together a whole bunch of latent threads throughout my life. The earliest seeds come from my own experiences with grief and loss. I lost my mom mm-hmm. 10 years ago, last September. And I come from a Reform Jewish background, which certainly isn't a Hasidic background. Sure. And yet there's a very specific rigid timeline for grief and rituals that offer sort of guideposts through that process. And I've always found, personally and objectively, those to be very wise and profound and intuitive. While they're ancient, they sort of understand our psychological process, and they actually allow for this period of excessive grief. From the confines of your own grief, and I think I came to realize, especially with the loss of my mom, that grief is highly specific. It's as specific as the relationship between the individual who's been lost and the individual that's left behind. You can have all of the rubrics and guideposts in the world, but at the end of the day, you're left with the specificity of your grief. And it spills outside of those boundaries, and it needs to be allowed to express itself either in conversation with those rituals or outside of those rituals. And the movie's just sort of this, I guess, very personal defense of the idiosyncrasies of grief and healing, in a very meta sort of way, you know, the movie is my own process of healing. Shmuel buries pigs, and I make a movie about a guy burying pigs.
There you go. You know, I mean, that's a good way, I'd imagine, to deal with things, is to make a movie.
Absolutely.
Certainly gets your mind off of things, I would imagine.
And 10 years on, you know, my grief persists outside of those boundaries of, for 7 days you do this, and 30 days you do this, and 1 year later you do this, and still needs its expression. And I write with a co-writer who I imagine will, you know, be able to bring up within our conversation. And his name is Jason Begay. He's the Albert to my Shmuel, the Goy to my at least cultural Jew, and in very many ways that collaboration, you know, is reflected in their relationship as well.
Right on, right on. Yeah, I also, you know, come from a Reformed Jewish background, and of course, Hasidics were around, you know, growing up. I was born in Brooklyn and grew up in Pennsylvania. I was always back into New York all the time. And yeah, you know, dealing with grief, and I actually myself haven't had a major grief situation to deal with. However, the Jewish faith, there seems to be so many lessons and so many so many teachings and things that, you know, we're given that are supposed to help with that thing. But like you said, at the end of the day, it's a very personal thing. And, there's no definitive answer to how to deal with it. And so, you know, it's cool that what you do with this film is take it to a place of, just where that search for answers could possibly lead somebody if they were, really having a hard go of it when it came down to that time, that hard time in their life.
Yeah, and there is this inherent, irony in the film that maybe as we were writing it, we considered, is this problematic or does it make it more interesting that, a proper Jewish burial is almost as green as they come.
Mm-hmm.
And Judaism, when it comes to sort of its relationship to death, is very humane.
Yeah.
And humanistic. And as you said, gives this sort of roadmap and this guidance some permission within those boundaries. And yet nonetheless, grief is specific, you know?
Sure. Sure. And another thing that makes the movie unique is how it's blending this story of grief with also, basically at its core, a wacky buddy comedy, and then also, a kind of fish out of water story. And, I'm just wondering, before we start jumping into some puzzle pieces, as we call the inspirations here on the show, was it always a film that you envisioned as kind of blending all of these kind of genres together? Or were those things that came together as you were starting to figure out, well, what exactly happens to this guy?
It's a combination of all of those things. As soon as I had the idea, I knew that it was darkly comic, mm-hmm. in terms of at least my own warped sense of humor. I didn't necessarily know that would translate. When I brought it to Jason, his first reaction was, this sort of starts to get into the puzzle pieces, right? He was like, this is a Val Lewton movie. this is The Body Snatchers. This is B-horror.
Right.
And it was very fun to lean into those things. And then essentially realizing as well as this relationship started to develop and as the writing process pushed that relationship together, that we did have this buddy comedy on our hands, and that leaning into that was valuable. And you talk about, I love this idea of your show and what it does. And I see art as a conversation and film specifically. And some people see things as theft, and I see it as, honoring your influences and standing on the shoulders of giants and entering into conversation with the medium and what came before. And when you get to play with those influences and flip them and subvert them and look at them from inside out, I there's a joy there. And this is a movie about juxtapositions, mm-hmm. the sacred and the profane, and these two characters, specifically the highbrow and the lowbrow, and the ways in which I think we tested and pushed the limits of what we knew was inherent in the material, delighted and surprised us as we were writing. I mean, the degree to which we were laughing out loud as we were writing the film, at least with each other, surprised us. And then even more so when the audience started laughing along, which you don't know for a long time if that's going to happen. I think it surprised us and delighted us. But I think more at its core, it wasn't this sort of cheap way of approaching it. It was, I see humor as being spiritual, and that laughter as being cathartic, not only in dealing with the gruesome realities of our, our biological ends, but also in terms of dealing with grief. And there was also very much a Jewish ethos to that gallows humor and the spiritual reclaiming and empowerment that happens when you're able to laugh alongside those emotions.
Yeah. We're good at finding humor in pretty much anything.
Yeah. I think. Absolutely.
I'm really glad to hear you say that about standing on the shoulder of giants and just like looking at inspiration as a good thing, because like that's something that I always wonder about with this show. Do filmmakers want to discuss their influences, and are they just like, shh, don't tell people, I found that so far, a lot of the filmmakers I've talked to, they really are interested in discussing the things that they love. And I think that's really cool. And then, like this year alone, I mean, we just had two movies that very clearly and obviously showed their influences with Jordan Peele's Us and Gaspar Noé's Climax that have like little Easter egg showing their actual influences right there on the screen. And so it's an interesting thing to see how filmmakers react when you start talking about the influences.
I think it's a joy to be able to, we do the junket, and it's a privilege to do the junket. And when you're talking at Q&As, and a lot of the stuff that comes up is emotional and thematic based, and the film geek inside me wants to talk about those things, and not in an egotistical way that says, look what I'm referencing, but in a way that wants to engage that love of the art form. I don't know. You can't get, you look at Scorsese, and I've heard one of our producers, Emily Mortimer, has had the privilege of working with him, and she says he just delights in that stuff on set. He owns it. He's like, I'm doing this angle because that's what Hitchcock would do,
Nice.
And it's not, again, it's not pretentious. It's the childlike and joyful and pure. I'm excited to be able to talk about it. And it's interesting to see, I mean, you look at somebody like P.T. Anderson's trajectory, who in his very early on his career was very forthcoming, wants to get on the phone with Jonathan Demme and say, look what I did. I copied your shot, and has become a little bit more quiet and mysterious. But you still get him in an interview. And I mean, you think about Inherent Vice, and he's just a kid talking about film noir.
So, just film nerds making films.
Yeah, so I'm excited. I actually, with all the talking that I've done about this film, haven't been able to engage it in this way. So I'm looking forward.
Nice. Well, with that said, I guess let's get into some of these puzzle pieces. Starting off, the first one that I think both Chris and I, Chris Cranock, who was my co-host for the episode, brought up was A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers film, which was just filled with Jewish mysticism and, really mined the whole Jewish thing for comedy, while also being a great, great little mystery of what exactly is going to happen next in this movie. You really kind of don't know where it's going to go. And I feel that that's something that could, very easily be said for To Dust as well. A movie where you just really don't know at any point what's going to happen next, and you're just kind of along for this crazy ride that's just filled with all kinds of crazy stuff.
The Coen brothers are huge for a lot of reasons that we can talk about, and A Serious Man is obviously huge. It is, I heard in your episode, it is the first time I heard about a Dybbuk as well. And then sort of followed that thread into the world of Isaac Bashevis Singer and the actual folklore of the Dybbuk, and landing it at the 1937 film, sort of in the process of writing and developing To Dust, and sort of finding kind of the layers and layers of that mythology, which are very, very beautiful. But obviously that spiritual search, that existential nature of that movie, of just needing answers and wanting answers. And I think that I don't know, one of the huge things about that film too was sort of permission to not be expository. I think that movie, it's obviously so Jewish, and it doesn't stop to explain its Jewishness, but its Jewishness also isn't, the film manages to be universal through that specificity. And I don't think that the film excludes people who don't get, the added texture. And writing with Jason, who is not Jewish, it was also very useful to, you know, to have that barometer on, well, I need to understand this, and we need to find a way to explain this element of the Judaism that doesn't feel, or the mysticism that doesn't feel expository, but this thing I don't need to understand. And that even came down to sprinkling Yiddish throughout the film, and what needed to be explained and what needed to just be mystifying or an added laugh for somebody, you know, for the 70-year-old who happens to get that.
I think it's also great having Matthew Broderick's character as kind of almost a guide, you know, an entryway in for anybody who isn't necessarily catching things. They could just, you know, be as lost as he is.
Yeah. And you know, and it does wait about, you know, 20 minutes to get him into the movie. But you are thinking about the reality of this world, and he's the only one who's allowed to ask questions believably. Shmuel can't stop to explain aspects of his faith to his rabbi. You know, and his rabbi can allude to things that obviously set the viewer up, but the rabbi also can't be over explicit about that lest it enter the realm of unrealistic, because he should know these things already.
Sure. Absolutely.
And then Albert, you know, a lot of that culture clash, fish out of water stuff that happens with Albert allows us to have a character reacting to the being mystified.
Yeah.
And us being, and he, him being an avatar for us.
Sure. Yeah.
In that way. And I, you know, to sort of use A Serious Man and as a way to leap into other Coen brother influences, I think that we exist in perhaps the same cinematic universe, but a very different moral universe than the Coen brothers. I think that the God in Into Dust, or which I guess is us as writers, are a bit kinder, and perhaps like all of the transgressions that Shmuel makes are sort of being helped along by.
Sure. Yeah. He's not getting punished too much
by the world. Yeah. And I would really hone in on the Coen brothers tonally, and I've always loved them, but what I've studied about them is, and they're masters of this, you know, when you're trying to do a tonal tightrope, the Holy Grail isn't, well, it's funny and then it's serious. It's that, wait, the funniest thing is the most tragic thing.
Sure.
And maybe it's tragic the first time you watch it and it's funny the second time you watch it. In retrospect, for, you know, encapsulated in the whole and contextualized in the whole film, or vice versa. It's a laugh out loud guffaw the first time you watch it, and then you realize, wait, that thing that I laughed at is actually the saddest thing in the film.
Right.
And I don't.
Well, I found one thing about the film is that, and I'm talking about To Dust here, is it's one of those movies where even if you're not specifically laughing at the scene, you may just find yourself just starting to laugh at just like, wow, this is crazy. You know, and you just kind of give yourself like almost like a nervous laughter of like, God, what are they going to get themselves into? You
know? Yeah. And that laughter, it's been very interesting to, and a privilege to be able to watch it with different audiences and to see, you know, does the laughter start at the first quote? Does the laughter start when he tears his coat? Or does the laughter start, you know, 25 minutes in at the first bacon joke? It's like, right. And this idea of, you know, these jokes are, they're groaners, some of them, they're dad humor, they're Jewish humor, they're Borscht Beltian, like in the lowest hanging fruit sort of way occasionally. But that's number one. I think that the idea of the humor is that it feels emotionally grounded and it feels real, even if it's surreal. And slightly that it feels emotionally real, and also that it's serving this thematic purpose of catharsis. Like, we're going to look at some pretty dark things, and sometimes from grief you need that that forced laugh as an entryway into healing. I sometimes get to tell the story about coming back from my mom's funeral and my dad putting the TV on, and Peter Sellers' The Party is on TV, and he's like, you have to come and watch this. And we're sitting and we're watching Peter Sellers, you know, slapsticky zaniness and laughing through tears and how healing that was. And, and I'll also say about the, you know, then sometimes that laughter's uncomfortable laughter. Sometimes it's a wry smile. Sometimes it's a release valve. into dust and sort of where it plays. And I will, you know, you ask about where did this come from and how instantly did we know that it would be all of these things juxtaposed in this way. And it was actually through the research into both forensic anthropology. I didn't know how to body decompose, and I assumed there'd be a pretty standard answer to it. And you go down the rabbit hole of this bizarre field of science, and you're trying to honor that reality. And then, you know, I assumed as a Reformed Jew who had studied religion as an undergrad that I knew what orthodoxy was. Just it was what I knew, but more serious. And I couldn't have been more wrong, and was beautifully humbled by that journey into the Orthodox world and then into the mysticism as well. And when you start putting these two things in conversation and honoring their reality, it actually creates more absurdity. Like, okay, there's a Hasidic man and forensic anthropology uses pigs. Like, how can you not lean into that?
Perfect.
Yeah,
it is. It's a perfect combination. And you know what? I before we move on to the next puzzle piece, I do want to ask about that. The whole pig angle, is that something that came out of the screenplay, or did you already like think of that while thinking about the breaking down of the body and things like that? Like, was that something that was in the back of your mind that wasn't necessarily for the screenplay, or did it come from like figuring out the journey for these people?
It came through figuring out the journey through these people. And we were able to incubate the project through grants from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which is this, I only ever had heard of them through NPR or PBS. They fund scientific research, but they have this small and beautiful, well-funded wing that funds science and the arts. And so we were getting grants to develop the film because of the scientific angle. And it felt, really kind of, I don't have a particularly scientific bent, but to honor that science, and in honoring that science and unearthing those things like pigs, like body farms, things that I didn't know existed. I knew he would, when the idea first occurred to me, I knew he would, try to decompose things or watch things decomposing, but I didn't know that it would be a pig yet.
Sure. There you go. All right. Well, let's go to another puzzle piece, and I'm going to keep it on another funny one before we move on to some serious ones. The film Swiss Army Man, which is another movie that deals with grief, more so mental illness, but they kind of go hand in hand, and it deals with it in a very a funny, a sweet, a weird way. And it's also another very unconventional buddy film, really, when you come down to it. Had you thought of Swiss Army Man? Have you seen Swiss Army Man? I know it's not as big of a movie.
I have seen it, and I think it came out after we wrote the script. I don't remember the exact timing, but folks were pointing us in that direction. Oh, you should watch this. Yeah. You know, I think that it was just starting to get its buzz. And the thing about that film, and there's obviously a whole bunch of other influences in this regard. It is, you know, I love divisive films. You hear about, you know, folks walking out of that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And folks staying. And can you handle these deep topics with fart jokes?
Sure.
And I come back to that humor as profound and humor as spiritual, and some people will see it as immature or juvenile. But I do think, I mean, a fart, I guess, being a literal release valve, like, I like, there's something beautiful. And I look at movies that I loved growing up that are maybe spiritual influences onto Dust, if not, not explicit ones. And those films that you're able to say, I just watched that. There was just a fart joke, but now I'm feeling this pervasive sense of melancholy or sadness. And, you know, let alone, you know, then there's the intellectual level, then perhaps there's the social commentary level. But for me, it's the ability to I just watched this thing, this combination of influences. I laughed and then somehow I'm crying. And the ability to flip that script and have it feel organic. And again, not a roller coaster necessarily of I laughed and then I cried. I laughed and cried simultaneously. And it's sort of, it's the trickster, like, you know, that the archetypal figure of the trickster that comes in and not, you know, to turn things on its head for a spiritual end. Like,
yeah.
And so I wouldn't say that Swiss Army Man is an influence. It didn't coincide chronologically to be able to be one, but I would say I feel we share influences.
Sure, absolutely. They come from a similar place of dealing with serious topics, but with very, you know, funny methods. All right, well, moving on to another one then, much more serious film, Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain, which is a movie in which a man searching for answers relating to death, it drives him to craziness. And while Schmuel doesn't exactly go crazy necessarily, it certainly leads him in a you know, a pretty wild journey along the way, trying to answer these questions for himself.
I have sadly never seen The Fountain, and it's been one of those long time get around to watching. Mm-hmm. But there is there's absolutely something of that ethos, and obviously, if you're pulling in Darren Aronofsky and the Hasidic world, there's this pi element, sure, as well, and this idea of the ways in which, you know, you think about pi, and I guess you think about the way that to dust, grafts the religion over the science and makes metaphors out of both of them while honoring the actuality, sure, of them. And I mean, I guess you think about pi and it's like this Kabbalistic mysticism in the hands of the purely spiritual being versus in the hands of the mathematician versus in the hands of the Wall Street, the folks trying to hack Wall Street, and it's in nature. And that, I think that pervades other Darren Aronofsky films as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny you're mentioning that because I had never thought about that before, but that theme, you know, kind of going between those two films, absolutely, it's an absolute great fit there.
Yeah, and yes, we can have a follow-up phone call about The Fountain.
Nice. Yeah, definitely a movie to seek out. Next puzzle piece then would be Hal Ashby's Being There, which is, you know, of course, classic fish out of water type of story, and one that Chris brought up. I mentioned it on the episode. I'm sure I saw it, but like when I was a kid, I haven't seen it in so many years. I barely remembered it, but you know, it's a classic.
This is my, and I don't know that my answer will be exactly what you guys saw in it in that connection. But my favorite thing about that film is the walking on water scene at the end. Mm. The final shot is he walks away and he walks on water. And it might have been Roger Ebert. You know, there's the thumbs up and thumbs down Roger Ebert, and then there's the true cinephile. Roger Ebert, and I love the cinephile Roger Ebert. I think he was talking about people are saying, is that real? Is it a dream? Is it supposed to be real? Is he Jesus-like? Is he mystical? And he said something, he's like, the movie forces you to accept that as real within the context of the film.
Sure.
The movie doesn't give you any other suggestions that it wouldn't be real. So you have to accept that at face value, but then you sort of enter into this idea of cinema as dream. Right. And so that, you know, what I do take away from being there, is that idea. And it's sort of to dust in this way. And we'll get into the other things that you had named as puzzle pieces along this vein as well. It crosses over into, I wouldn't say it's full-fledged fever dream, but it is this blurred line between the gravitas of his grief in the beginning and end, and of sort of the daytime scenes and the absurdity of the nighttime scenes. And, sure, it crosses over into something that feels more like folklore and cinematic mythology, and the dream of grief. And it's like the movie lives in that ambiguity in the way that last scene in Being There does, and purposefully so. It's not the type of Wizard of Oz thing where, they have to wake up to know that it was all a dream.
Right,
it's like,
right.
No, film is a dream and cinema is the language of dreams. And that's why you can have films that I don't know, you think about The Prophet or something that are ultra realistic and throw in one element of magical realism.
Yeah, because I mean, that's an inherent thing about cinema is that you can do that. And, you know, especially for a story that's dealing with things that, you know, don't necessarily have easy answers. It's like, why not go there and try things and do things that are going to make it unique.
Yeah, that make it unique, that add flavor, but that also feel purposeful. I feel like, yeah, the movie asks you to treat this as reality to some extent, but it also asks you to look at the subjective emotional elements of it all as well. And we've had audiences walk out, which I wear as a badge of honor. I don't want to offend anybody's sensibilities, but the movie is asking us to look at dark things, and everyone has a very different threshold for that. Whether it's, I don't want to watch a video of a pig decomposing, a film reel of a pig decomposing, or I don't think that death should be treated with this sense of humor. And I would find that people who took the movie at the most literal level were the ones who wound up being the most offended by it or not getting it in the way that we would hope that one would get it. But I spoke to a man, was at a Jewish film festival in South Florida where I happen to be from. And he says, I thought it felt like the external expression of this man's inner experiences. Hmm. I was like, yeah. and it's been being given permission to do that. You know, And it transcends into cinema and the catharsis of cinema and the catharsis allowed in mixing those things and those languages and moving between them in ways that feel obscured in the way that a dream feels. And so, I don't want to preempt your next puzzle pieces, but I'm very excited about this one because you guys honed in on not just Jarmusch, but Down by Law specifically, which is, I mean, it made me giddy when I heard you guys say that because that is direct. Like that is in the DNA, and you know, not in sort of a pat on the back. Like I've never heard anybody call that out that directly, and I felt recognized and gotten.
Chris is going to be so happy that you're saying that right now.
Yeah, and there's obviously these Jarmuschian, you know, paces and tones and very specifically the strange odd couplings. But Down by Law specifically, and it does this similar thing to that last scene in Being There. It's, they never wake up from the dream, and obviously their circumstances are strange and there's an oddness to the world in these characters. But you're asked to treat it very realistically. Like these three weird guys end up in a jail cell together. And then you look at the escape and they're casually talking about, Roberto Benigni's casually talking about a hole in the fence that he found or something or other. And the next thing you see is this very noir German expressionistic shot of them running down a tunnel. It just like, they just escaped. You're just supposed to buy into that. Yeah. And everything that happens afterwards in that way, you know, we're talking about moral universes with the Coen brothers, like the world's, you know, God seems to be smiling upon their escape. Like somehow they get away from the cops and the barking dogs, and somehow Roberto Benigni finds the love of his life, like in an hour at the end of the film. And there are these strange echoes of that cabin that they find being exactly like the jail cell. And it feels like the using cinema, that like the prisoner escape genre, and turning it into a dream, and it becomes the dream of escape. But it's not, again, it's not the Wizard of Oz where they have to wake up at the end, because you don't have to wake up from a movie or in the context of a movie. And then all of that ease with which they escape, and even some of the conflicts that they have, but the beauty of kind of the heaven that they find, at least specifically Benigni, is beautiful and melancholic and profound, and it's a shift that happens in the middle of the movie that just asks you to run with it and buy in with it and not question it, because it's real within the context of the film, but clearly it's poetry.
Absolutely. And you know, not to heap, you know, so much flattery and praise here, but that, you know, to your direction, I mean, that's why I think people are able to, you know, not ask those questions and just go along with everything within your film as to this being a world and this being what these characters are going through and just, you know, being totally, totally down to go on that journey.
And I fully respect that there's folks who don't buy in early and, you know, and don't get the movie and either it didn't do anything for them or it offended their sensibilities, but yeah, if you're, you know, I do love that divisiveness and the conversation that it creates. And if you're willing to buy in, then you do go along because there is hopefully an emotional and thematic reality.
The best movies are divisive when it comes down to it.
And that surrealism and the idea in terms of leaning into these genre tropes and leaning into these influences, the thing that Jason and I always ask ourselves is you can't do that cheaply. If it's just a wink, then it's self-congratulatory, intellectual exercise. But the question is there a thematic resonance? Is there an emotional resonance? Why are we mashing up horror and comedy and bacon jokes and philosophical spiritual meditations? And there has to be a purpose and a reason. And more than anything else, emotionality, I think, to be able to justify doing that thing, or else it becomes a cheap trick.
I completely agree with that, and it's a fine line, but you know, obviously, I feel like you rode that line really well.
Thank you so much.
So I'm gonna bring up one more of the puzzle pieces we had talked about, and then I'll ask you if there's any that we you know, left out of our conversation that you have in mind. And that is 2001, A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick. And the reason why I brought it up is, you know, obviously the film is a search for answers, as much for the story itself and the characters as it is for its filmmaker. And I feel like, you know, obviously you've mentioned earlier about your own experiences with grief. And, you know, it feels like To Dust is, you know, an exercise in you know, looking for answers, but in a world and a film where you're not going to get easy answers. There is never going to be easy answers, but you still go on that journey anyway.
When you guys threw that into the mix, it was such an honor to hear that. I mean, Jason and I love Kubrick and talk about him, and it's funny because the project that we're working on now, we've really thought a lot about 2001 in no direct obvious way, but as sort of a spiritual predecessor, right?
I'm excited.
Yeah, well, for one, you know, I'm incredibly squeamish, and I don't like to face these realities. And the movie was this personal therapy, not only processing my mom's grief, but my own existential fears and concerns, and sort of throwing the gauntlet down to myself to be able to look at those taboos and try to find the beauty in them. So it's certainly, you know, the fact that I feel like, I don't know, it's exciting and an honor, and it's the beauty of art to be able to enter the conversation and put this out into the world. But if the film was only just my own personal therapy, that would have been enough. That strangeness that when you do get vulnerable and dark and weird and throw out the unsavory, strange thoughts that you have, that's actually when you tap into universality, is exciting, not just in a self-congratulatory way, but that's the beauty of art.
Absolutely.
So why make a movie if it isn't a personal quest or exploration or journey, or that you are asking those questions? And I do think that I don't like didactic films. I like films that are about the questions and not about the answers. And I think it is a very Jewish thing as well. It's the Jewish dialectic that a question is answered with a question is answered with a question. And that ultimately it lands, and as you say, with 2001, and I don't know that we were explicitly thinking about this, at this place of mystery and humility. And however far, you know, science can take you, however far religion can take you, however far one's own grief can take them. Like you have to be, whether, you know, it's the outer reaches of religion or science or the inner reaches of a human heart. Like you can do all the math and all the algorithms and all the working and all the attempt to explain, but at the end of the day, you're left with mystery, and that mystery is daunting and terrifying for some folks, but it's also beautiful and profound and spiritual to just surrender to that mystery.
Right.
And I think that you know, one of the things that I was finding and that we were exploring, and I was exploring and learning and asking those questions for myself and to Dust, are the ways in which religion and science end at the same place. And it's the more you know, the more you don't know.
Right.
And that again can frustrate people to no end, but that they, you know, that Albert and Shmuel archetypally representing the things that they represent, right? Like recognize that about the secular and the spiritual.
Right.
And then at the end, yeah, you just, I think you guys had nailed it. Like you can backwards engineer the science to match the religion and to graft one over the other. But at the end of the day, it's about what you need as an individual to survive. And perhaps it's all just some grand, MacGyvering of oh, well, you know, a buffet of this scientific fact works with this religious fact, and I'm gonna patch them together to justify the thing that I just need to do emotionally.
Like, right. I just need my answer that I already have,
and find some rationalization to act on that. So you just have to marvel at the end of 2001. I got to see it in 70 last year. On my birthday, and it was a joy because it was in New York at the Village East, and Spielberg was coming out of the previous screening. And I mean, I'm derailing off of To Dust and just film geeking out, but
oh, that's fine.
But he, I don't know, Spielberg has to have his own theater and could have access to his own 70 millimeter print and has probably seen 2001 times. And yet felt it was this cinematic event that he needed to see again in this way in a theater. And what I love about that movie is you get to the end and you can try to explain it. Why is there Victorian art? in this white room at the ends of the galaxies that might be God's house, who knows, but no, it's actually crafting its own religion. It's supposed to mystify you, and it's supposed to humble you by mystifying you in the way that the mysteries of the universe do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it doesn't, you don't need to crack it. It's not supposed to be.
That's the best kind of movie. You're never gonna fully crack. You're gonna have your theories. You're gonna have your all your different readings. But at the end of the day, you got so much to just keep going back to.
Yeah.
And keep looking at it. That brings me to the end of the pieces that I was specifically gonna bring up. Do you have any specific influences or inspirations that affected you in the making of this that we didn't talk about that you would like to bring up?
I don't want to give a shout out. I know that you guys, you know, we're talking about the animation, and you specifically, brought up Tim Burton, and I feel like that's the 9-year-old in me. Yeah. I saw Beetlejuice, at a summer screening in New York on a big screen years ago and forgot how many times I must have seen that movie as a kid and how that movie probably made me want to make movies.
Right.
And it's interesting because you go back to your earliest influences and the ones that are somehow embarrassing, like, oh, that was a juvenile love. And sometimes it's actually going back to those places. I was a singer-songwriter, perhaps somewhere in me I still am, but it's what I pursued throughout my 20s. And I remember somebody referencing that in terms of songs. It's like, go to those, go to John Denver, like go to those earliest places that made me fall in love with music that are syrupy and saccharine. And there's going to be some truth there that made you want to do this thing that you have to honor. And one of the things that I love about to dust is in my short film work, there was always this darkly comic element to it. But I think I was trying to ground it in realism and character study, you know, especially as I was working my way through NYU, which is an amazing institution. But there's also this NYU ethos of what indie film means. And with the inspiration of To Dust, like all of these old influences came flooding back. I'm like, I can be funny and I can tap my inner Tim Burton and all of these things that I loved about film and that brought me into film. And then merged with the life experience that I had of losing my mom and as a 35-year-old and being able to meet that gravitas and melancholy with those childish obsessions and find the profundity in them, in putting them together, you know, and To Dust allowed like all of these, you know, I said it in the beginning, these latent threads to rush into this film, whether it's genre influences and tonal mashups. And so, yeah, so I, you know, I wrote the first draft of the script, you know, when I was thinking about that toe image, it literally says in stop motion fashion.
Nice.
And I went searching the internet and thereby the world for a collaborator to execute those things. And I stumbled across this incredible artist, Robert Morgan, who's in the UK, and on a whim and a wing and a prayer sent him the script and he responded to it. And we entered this year plus long collaboration. To this day, we've never been in the same room or the same country. It was all over Skype, but we know each other's dark and strange souls. And I urge any of your listeners to dig up his work online, because he's obviously digging from that tradition of stop motion as well, of the grotesque. And he has these beautiful philosophies of the ways in which why stop motion suits itself to horror, because it's like the animation of inanimate objects and the uncanny valley that happens with that. You know, and it's exactly what To Dust is about. He's reanimating a dead thing. And his approaches too, he uses life casts of real body parts in his own work. But the thing about his work was that there was always this melancholy that pervades it. And even in his most surreal work, there is this emotional truth and this dreamlike nature to it. You know, he became a collaborator and a de facto influence just based on his own expertise and his own voice.
That's cool.
Bringing those things to life. So Robert Morgan, do check him out. And I think he's in the works on his own first feature now as well. And I cannot wait to see it.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'm going to have to look him up, because I am a big fan of stop motion. And yeah, I mean that intersection between stop motion and horror is just, it's such a perfect place for it. I had a stop motion music video made for one of my darker tracks, and it's just, I love it so much. Like just watching that kind of creepy dark thing happening and that kind of animation, it's the coolest.
Yeah. Thing. And I, again, derail into film geekness. I have a 4-year-old daughter, and it's the biggest, you know, one of the biggest joys to get to introduce her to film. And we literally went to see Missing Link a couple weeks ago in Leica animation. It's, you know, it's beautiful, but it's very pristine. And we just went to see at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York for her spring break. They do this great kids programming, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, Wallace and Gromit, Aardman. And the difference of that, where it's like you see the thumbprints in the clay, and when that stuff is being put on a big screen,
oh yeah,
I think that if anything is my biggest frustration with the evolution of Tim Burton. I'm like, why the CGI? I want the sand shark from Beetlejuice. Yeah. Like, bring that stuff back, please.
He's got to know that we want it,
you
know, someone just let him do it, because he's got to know.
Yeah,
he's got to know. Well, right on. Did you have any others that you wanted to mention?
Other influences? There's so many. I think that when we, and I kind of like dovetail on things that you had mentioned as well, you know, when Jason said this is a B-horror movie and it's Val Lewton, this kind of deep dive into the world of Val Lewton was really lovely and exciting. And so you have the Body Snatchers and you have Isle of the Dead, And then specifically Curse of the Cat People. And this stuff that's sort of using German expressionism and but also taking genre and turning it into poetry and something mm-hmm. profound and something deeper. And
right.
You know, the I guess the story of Val Lewton at RKO is even if the studio got frustrated with him, he was kind of given permission to just, you know, as long as it's a sequel to Cat People, like do whatever you want. Like as long as it has this title and this poster, you know, run with it. And he wanted to take genre and turn it into art. And very explicitly, obviously, the Body Snatchers, you know, they're digging up a body at the end and it's raining. Which right, is Frankenstein right. too.
And, sure.
Which is a trope, like the cinematic trope of the midnight exhumation in a pool.
Well, I think it by law has to be raining while you're digging up a body, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's just how it goes.
Of course, and then there's the sense too of, you know, like okay, we're watching something, you know, that feels it's rain and it's cinematic and it feels familiar, but I also can't believe that I'm feeling some emotion. At right, the same time, right. And that's how you know, that's the exciting flip or the magic trick when it works and for whom it works. And, you know, does that rain become other things? Is that rain purification? I don't know. Is that rain and strange influence here, you know, like Solaris. And that last, you know, Solaris might as well be a metaphor for filmmaking. It's like, here's this planet that takes emotions and turns them into manifested things.
Right.
And and my favorite, I don't know if it was Kurosawa or my favorite thing I'd ever read about Solaris was the sense of that rain at the end. It's raining on the planet now, and that rain is tears. It, like, it took the sadness and it turned it into rain.
Like, right.
And so can you take that trope? It has to be raining in a cemetery. Of course it does. You know, it's in Frankenstein. It's in Young Frankenstein. It's in Sam right. Raimi, you know, Drag Me to Hell. You take those, that trope, and then you try to find the poetry in it. And I think that Val Lewton is one of the predecessors of and forward thinkers of that. And you take, you know, something like Curse of the Cat People, and it becomes this meditation on childhood trauma and the deep, dark emotions of childhood. And it becomes used, it disappoints audiences, but it becomes used in psychology classes to this day as this examination of child psychology through a ghost story, through genre. And it was this hope and dream that we had for the movie, like can To Dust be a midnight movie? Can To Dust be Big Lebowski in some regard and also be find a home with grief counselors? And there's this beautiful movement happening that's been dubbed the death positive movement about, you know, how do we as a culture calibrate our relationship to death? And there's this institute in New York called the Art of Dying Institute, and these folks out in LA who have this green funeral home and this nonprofit called the Order of the Good Death. And the movie's starting to find a home with them. They teach thanatology, which is the, you know, how folks who are death workers and how you work with death and how you work with someone who's dying and grief counselors. And there's, you know, does this movie find its home in the Jewish world? There's the Chevra Kadisha, which is the Jewish Burial Society. Geza Rohrig, our actor from Son of Saul, is actually a member of a Chevra Kadisha. And you would think that perhaps, you know, there's folks who there's Orthodox or there's Jewish folks who this movie might offend, but we found this home with, we're going to be screening at a Chevra Kadisha convention in Denver over the summer. And there's this sense of, yeah, if you're there, you know, you could think it's offensive, but if you're there spiritually doing one of the most selfless and holy acts of Judaism, which is to prepare a dead body, and you get this movie, like, not as offensive, but as speaking to your work and the spiritual profundity of that. So there's that sense of like, can this movie be, you know, I've a friend's father who was a Christian pastor who worked in, who was a teacher and who worked in a a hospital for most of his life, helping families through their grief, and teaches about grief and counseling to young clergy, saw this film and said, this film is so psychologically true to my understanding of grief. And so that sense of like, can it be a stoner comedy and this other thing? And that's exciting to me, that our ultimate hope and dream for it, you know, like it's starting to pan out and starting to find those strange homes, and it's a niche film, right? And I hope that, sure, that in the VOD world and in its home entertainment afterlife, it perhaps finds, you know, more of an audience than it was allowed to or able to find in the theaters. And I'm so grateful that we had this beautiful theatrical run and that our distributor Good Deed believed in it in that way. But you hope that in these bizarre long tales and afterlives of the film itself, that you know, it can do both those things. And I think that Val Lewton is a predecessor of that to some extent. And then you also look at, other folks who have done that. Then you look at the Dybbuk, the movie, and I could go on for 45 minutes about the beauty in that and the poetry of that and the way in which that genre like feels like Val Lewton, and it's taking the Dybbuk and turning it into a metaphor for grief in 1937 in Yiddish. and how that became an influence and actually incorporated into our movie, and so ahead of its time for doing that. But then you look at things like the Babadook, which, you know, it's obviously a metaphor for grief, but it's not until that final scene where it takes horror and turns it into that poetry.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And I,
where it finally brings it in.
Yeah, and I look at, it could go on forever and just like love to throw out all the influences, but you look at Altman doing that with McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Like, here's a Western. And then in the last 5 minutes, it's transfigured into poetry in this way that it hadn't felt, you know, for the rest of the movie. So those are, those are spiritual influences for the film. I think in that same realm and in that same era, there is this Night of the Hunter-ness to it. You know, there was a vision of the movie, you know, at some point that quickly got put aside about the movie actually being in black and white, but also ways in which we can still evoke that, like, you know, actually in cooler ways, like once you're embracing color, the nights can start to feel increasingly black and white. And sure, what are shadows doing? You know, and there's shots like the silhouettes of the farm when Shmuel's stealing the pig.
Oh yeah, which, yeah, you know, some really cool shots.
Feel Night of the Hunter-ish and trying to throw nods in that direction. But I do think that Night of the Hunter feels simultaneously real, even in the way that it starts kind of handheldy and but it also feels folkloric and fairy tale like. And the way in which To Dust is trying to walk that line between it's real and it's, you know, you can't ever peg, is this a period piece? Is it not a period piece? When does this take place? And it's clearly in a modern world because we're dealing with a modern science, but that it is allowed to be knocked into the folkloric realm. It's sort of modern folklore. And
sure.
And I think about, you know, in the literary world, kind of, and specifically the Jewish world and Jewish mysticism in modern settings and sort of postmodern Jewish mystical tales of Isaac Bashevis Singer. And can you have that stuff that it feels recognizably real, but it also feels heightened?
Right, right.
That's true of what we were talking about with Down by Law.
Yeah.
And Jarmusch as well.
Absolutely.
I could dig deep and then talk about shots and those fun little, you know, like I'll always lay those references in there just because they're superfluous and fun and individual things, but I feel like we're hitting the big ones on the thematic end.
I think so too, you know. And speaking of which, you know, I think that we've kind of hit the main things, but I do have one question for you, and then we'll probably wrap it up here. And that final question is, was it always Jethro Tull?
It was always Jethro Tull, in the same way that it was always a stop motion toe. I don't know where these things come from, you know, like I had an older cousin who, loved Jethro Tull, who I loved and admired. And, Albert is not necessarily in any way like him, and yet somehow, like, I was like, what's he listening to? It's Jethro Tull. it's clearly, you know, and there would have, you know, if I'm so grateful to our producers, Emily Mortimer, Alessandra Nivola, Ron Perlman, of the, you know, the celebrity producers, and then Josh Crook, Scott Lachmas, these producers who fought, and music supervisors who fought these good fights to get us a movie of our size and budget to be able to use both Tom Waits and Jethro Tull.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there'd be more Jethro Tull in the movie if it wasn't, you know, so expensive.
Oh, I'm sure.
They have simply used Aqualung almost in its entirety.
I'm sure. Well, right on. Sean, seriously, this has been so great. Thank you so much for doing it. And, you know, now that the film's on VOD, I really do think it's going to find an even bigger audience. You know, it's a great movie. So unique and well done and great performances. And I'm just really happy that you were able to make the time to do this interview. I had a great time. And yeah, just want to thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I'm so happy and grateful that you guys found it, that you guys were compelled enough to track it down for the week that it played wherever you are.
Yeah, yeah. One week in the theaters here, but we were there.
And it's such an honor, and it was a joy and quite humbling to hear you guys talk about it, and quite exciting to you know, you find that it works in ways that you want it to work, and you find that people are taking their own thing out of it, and that's all you can hope for. So thank you guys for liking the movie and dissecting it in a beautiful, loving way. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much, man.
Welcome to the world's first podcast. Well, the first one they've done. Gas Money Pictures presents Filmmakers On, a podcast for filmmakers by filmmakers about the ever-changing media landscape. Each Thursday, hosts Jay Horton and Sean Alden Reed speak to a media insider about their journey through the industry and how to survive without going crazy. Segments like What Are You Watching?, Media Roundup, and It's Your Turn give Jay and Sean the opportunity to do their favorite thing, discuss what's going on in movies, TV, and media, and mainly disagree. Filmmakers On is available on your favorite podcasting app or at www.filmmakerson.com. And check them out on social media at Filmmakers On.
That was a great conversation, right? Man, thanks so much to Sean Snyder for being here. I'm just so glad that it went so well like that. I mean, I told you on the last episode, I loved this movie, and so to have him on was great. And I'm really glad it sounded like he had a great time, too. So that does it for now. We're going to be back with a whole lot more Piecing It Together coming up this Friday, and then continuing, I think we got two episodes for next week, although don't quote me because it might just be one, but it might be two. We'll see what happens. And you should all make sure that you are subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. You should also follow us on social media at Piecing Pod, join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, a movie discussion group where we continue the conversations about all these movies and puzzle pieces. And you know what? If you really want, we actually have a Patreon now, patreon.com/piecingpod. You can sign up for it. I don't know what you're going to get at this point, but you'll be supporting the show. You really don't have to sign up. But if you really want to sign up, sign up. That would be kind of cool. Anything you put into it, it's just going to go back into making the show better and bigger. So, you know, whatever. If you really enjoy it, go for it. Why not? You can also rate and review us on iTunes. I'm just telling you all this stuff that you can do if you enjoy what you hear on Piecing It Together. So, that about does it for today. I'm going to leave you guys with a piece of music, as I always do. And I talked about on the previous episode about my stop-motion animation music video, Back Into the Dark, which came up when I was searching for cool, dark, stop-motion animation videos after researching To Dust. And, yeah, I might as well play that song, right? So Back Into the Dark is a track from my third album, Head Like Fire. And the music video is just this super cool stop-motion animated horror music video thing that came out a couple years ago, got into like 14 film festivals, won a bunch of awards. It's something I'm super proud of, and hope you dig it. So let's go with Back Into the Dark, and we'll be back with more Piecing It Together coming up.
And all points west.